Thank you so much for having me. I speak for a living at this point. I give maybe one or two talks a week, and this is, and I'm not pandering to the audience here, well, a little bit, but I'm so excited to be here. I used to be a sysadmin. My first job out of college was a sysadmin, been using Linux since I was 12. And so, what's that? That's what happens when you don't have any other hobbies in high school. And so I'm just really excited to speak to an audience that I can actually say, like, you are my people, or I am one of you. And I'm also, I mean, this I hope will be a little bit of tough love for a community that I think needs to receive it. All right, so as I said before, I used to be a sysadmin. I'm the principal technologist for the ACLU, which means I explain technology to lawyers. I don't run our web server. I'm not responsible for the TLS configuration on our servers. I don't fix the printers. I explain surveillance to lawyers. And in particular, what I do is I act as a translator. So I try and figure out what's happening in the technical community. I read all the papers at Usenix and Oakland and CCS, all the security conferences. And then I try to figure out what law enforcement and the intelligence community are doing, how they are spying on people. And then I feed that information to my colleagues, and then we sue the government. Thank you for suing the government. So for example, if you've read about a device called a Stingray in the newspaper, anyone know what a Stingray is? Hands? All right, cool. So that's because of me. I spent 4 years hunting Stingrays. And then my most recent project has been to figure out how the FBI and other law enforcement agencies are hacking into people's computers. There's actually been a dedicated team of agents at Quantico since 2002 who do nothing but deliver malware to people's devices. Last year, I revealed that the FBI had impersonated the Associated Press back in 2007 in an effort to trick a teenager into downloading malware onto his computer. And so this is, as the surveillance techniques that law enforcement and the intelligence community use become increasingly more high-tech, it's vital that the civil liberties groups who are fighting for your rights also have the in-house capabilities to be able to translate and do this stuff. I'll also say that one of the first things that I did after starting at the ACLU was to bring on another technologist, a guy named Daniel Kahn Gilmore, who is a Debian developer. He is active at the IETF, and we now have IETF RFCs with the ACLU's name on it, which makes me really proud again as an engineer. All right, so I should also confess a few things. So some of you may know that back in 2006, I got in trouble with the FBI for making a website that made fake boarding passes. At the time, the no-fly list was big in the news, and I wanted to demonstrate the ease with which someone could circumvent the no-fly list. And to do this, I figured a high-profile demo would be the best way to do it. So I made this website, and anyone could go there, and if you didn't change the default settings on the web form, it would make a boarding pass for Osama bin Laden. And this was not received too well by those in power, and the FBI kicked down my front door at 2 in the morning a couple days later. So this is the confession part of my talk. So when this happened in 2006, I had a bachelor's degree in computer science, I had at least 1 year of full-time work as a sysadmin under my belt, and then internships and other things. I had a master's degree in computer security from Johns Hopkins, and I was in my first year in a PhD program in computer security, Indiana. And when the FBI came knocking down, or when they kicked down my door, and they took all my stuff, not a single hard drive that I owned was encrypted. Every bit of data that the FBI seized was in plain text. And again, I had a master's degree in computer security. I had I had written plenty of stuff in class, plenty of crypto code, but in my mind, the thing that I did at school was different than the way that I practice my life. I can tell you truthfully that until a couple years ago, I wasn't using a password manager, and I was reusing the same passwords everywhere on the web, and it was only when data breach after data breach after data breach happened that I thought, shit, I gotta do something about this, this is really bad. And so, before I come and lecture you and say, okay, guys, you need to wake up, I just want to be the first to acknowledge that I was a bit slow to this party as well. I haven't always practiced the best personal security, and in many ways I got forced to do so by sheer embarrassment from some of my friends. But I'm saying this because I don't want you to feel like I'm judging you from some kind of position, like, oh, shame on you. I have crappy security too. Okay, so before I get going, I want to ask a few questions from the audience. Some hands in the air. So in the last week, who in the room has opened a PDF file that they accessed from an unencrypted HTTP link, not in a virtual machine on their computer? Okay, most of the room. Who has done the same but for a PDF file that was emailed to them in the last week? Who in the last week has emailed credentials to someone in their organization in plain text? Okay, a couple hands. You know who you are. And then I'm really excited. I think this is the next slide. I'm really excited that I can actually use this in this audience. Who's run a command like this? All right. So we know why this is bad, right? So first, it's HTTP, and then piping it to sudo. Both. Sorry? Yeah, I know that there's a few dash options that I removed to make it cleaner. Thank you very much. Telling me, man. Tough audience. Okay. All right, so I think what this captures, right, this like the, you know, there are doctors who smoke cigarettes, there are public health workers who have unprotected sex, and there are, of course, people in this room who know better, who are engaging in unsafe computer behavior. You all know that you shouldn't be opening up random PDF files on your main machine, particularly ones that are emailed to you. You know that you shouldn't be downloading random shell scripts from the internet and then piping them to a shell, but you do it. Why is it that we are able to separate the security knowledge we have from our daily practice? And I didn't ask like how many of you have done this in a professional setting versus a personal setting, but I think many of us feel like our responsibility to run secure systems ends at 6 o'clock. When you go home, it's okay to have, you know, an easy password on your personal machine. When you go home, it's okay to not upgrade the packages on your computer. Your responsibility to practice good information security is only in the workplace where ultimately you're accountable. So hopefully, many of you have paid attention, at least some attention, to the Snowden stories that have come out. And, you know, as I said, you know, in 2006, when the FBI raided my house, my data wasn't encrypted. More embarrassingly, I didn't start encrypting my hard disks until 2009. You would have thought that, like, having the government come and take all my data and then look through it would have been, like, the wake-up call I needed, but it wasn't. For 3 more years, I had plain text, personal, sensitive data on devices in my house. Now, when Snowden came on the scene, and I should be clear, Ed is our client. My boss is one of Ed's prime lawyers, and we've been working with Ed for some time. When my boss first approached me and said, hey, look, we have a client who's dictating the security that he wants. And let me be clear, this is not normal. Normally, when a client approaches the ACLU for representation, we know more about technology, we know more about privacy and security than they do. But Ed is a special client. Ed knows a lot about computer security. And so he was dictating the security that we had to follow. And as someone who'd been advocating for strong security within the organization and maybe not receiving the attention that I wanted for that, it was really delightful to have a client saying, no, I will not let you represent me unless you use this kind of operating system on this kind of computer with this kind of graphics card because I don't trust this chipset. It was really sort of cool. But when the Snowden disclosures started coming out, it was a wake-up call for my organization. But I think it was a wake-up call for many in the engineering community. And there have been story after story after story, and so it's tough to sort of keep track of everything. And I'm like, I try and read every single story, and even some of them in my mind blur together. You know, the first big story, of course, was the news that the FBI and NSA were obtaining records from every telephone company in the country of every telephone call. Now, to be clear, they were not tapping the calls. They were merely getting the metadata of the calls. But that meant that they had a database of every call to an abortion clinic or a suicide hotline or Alcoholics Anonymous line. Calls where the metadata revealed very sensitive information. So that was the first big story that kicked it off. And people said, oh my goodness, this is outrageous. How dare the government do this? But that wasn't really a story that hit the technical community. Then there was a story about GCHQ, which is the British intelligence agency, spying on the unencrypted links between Google's data centers, Yahoo's data centers, and Twitter's data centers. And I don't know how many of you remember when this story came out. I didn't include this in the slide, but when the story came out, the Washington Post reporters spoke to some Google engineers, and they said that the response from the Google engineers after being shown this photo where it says SSL added and removed here could not be printed in the Washington Post. It's not family friendly. And so the engineers at Google were unhappy to learn that these private links between their data centers were being tapped. But I think for many in the community, the response was actually, what? Hang on, Google's not encrypting the links between its data centers? Right? And so the surprise there wasn't so much that the government was doing this, but that the companies hadn't been protecting this. And to their credit, Google and Twitter and Yahoo and Microsoft, they all fixed this pretty quickly afterwards. They all started encrypting this stuff. And to be clear, most of them had been encrypting the links over the public internet. Before that, it was these private links on leased lines that they hadn't been encrypting. And so, you know, these stories have come out of bulk interception of HTTP content, bulk interception of address books, exploitation of security flaws, exploitation of weak algorithms or insecure default settings. And I think for many people, not just like the average person, but people in this room, the response has been, well, because I think, you know, at its core, you know, most people don't think that what they're doing is that exciting, right? And so, okay, you read the story in the news, and maybe, like, if you're really enraged, you post a comment on Slashdot or Hacker News, and then maybe, like, you re-up your EFF membership and get a new T-shirt. But that's the extent of your response, right? And that really what it boils down to, I think, is this idea that, like, I have nothing to hide. My life is actually boring. And so what are they going to learn? They're going to learn that, you know, I have photos of my cats and of my kids and that I play video games on weekends and that I go hiking or whatever you guys do. You're probably thinking that you're not doing things that are that sensitive. And so why should you spend the time and energy into upping your security? Right? You feel like you're smart enough to suss out the average phishing email from a real email. You're not dumb enough to download a malicious DivX codec that many users will do. You cannot be tricked into installing a browser toolbar by one of the many online ad companies. And you feel like, okay, I can take care of myself. So why do I need to worry? You're like, the things that I really should be worrying about, cybercrime, I can take care of that. And I'm not really a target for a three-letter agency. And I think for the average person, that is indeed a rational response. For the average person, although most people in DC are not average, but for the average person out there, they probably don't have to worry about the NSA or GCHQ, or the Israelis, or the Russians, or the Chinese. The average person is just getting along with their lives, and realistically, they don't need to worry about being compromised by a nation-state adversary. But you're not average people. Even if your lives are boring, you have access to really important credentials. You have access to really interesting systems. And so the purpose of my talk today is to hopefully shake you into understanding that you need to protect yourself even if you think your life is boring. All right, so last year, President Obama, after wave after wave after wave of Snowden story, he gives this speech, his biggest speech on surveillance. He says, and this is, you know, in the wake of spying on Angela Merkel and all these bad stories that come out, people abroad are pissed off. Europeans are talking about, you know, blocking Google and Facebook and using the European cloud, which is somehow more secure than the American cloud. And so the president, facing this threat of Europe cutting off U.S. tech companies, says the bottom line is that people around the world, regardless of their nationality, should know that the United States is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security. And when you listen to this statement, this sounds okay, right? The average French person, as long as they're not a member of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, they don't have to worry about the NSA turning their massive lens towards them. The average German simply doesn't need to worry about the NSA if you're not up to no good. And if you're up to no good, well, then you deserve everything the NSA sends your way. So who are the kinds of people who threaten national security? Obviously, Vladimir Putin is probably on NSA's shit list. And you would expect that. I don't think I need to explain this one either. So clearly, leaders of states that are opposed to the US are going to be fair game in NSA's eyes. These people threaten our national security. It turns out Angela Merkel is also in that list. Turns out that the leaders of any country with whom we have significant economic relationship is fair game, because we want to know what they're up to. And after the Spiegel story describing NSA spying on Merkel came out, the president actually established a policy where he would exempt certain world leaders from friendly countries from NSA surveillance, but not their staff. So Angela Merkel's emails and telephone calls won't get spied on, but all her assistants will be still. So of course, it doesn't really do anything. So who else is fair game in the eyes of the NSA? When you look at what the president said, and he says, we are only listening to your email, or reading your emails and listening to your phone calls if you pose a threat to US national security, who else is in that list other than foreign governments? Well, obviously, you know, hackers working for foreign governments or allied with foreign governments, these are, of course, are the sort of half dozen Chinese hackers that DOJ indicted last year. We would expect the NSA to turn their surveillance apparatus on foreign hackers who are trying to steal data from U.S. systems, whether U.S. companies, in the case of the North Korean hack against the alleged North Korean hack against Sony, or hacks against defense contractors and other organizations. Two years ago, Glenn Greenwald published some slides from his NSA cache showing that the NSA had penetrated the systems of Petrobras, which is Brazil's big state-owned oil company. And it's weird, how does this oil company threaten national security? And so it turns out, if you follow NSA logic, the price of oil is a really important thing politically and in terms of geopolitical national security. The US really wants to know if the price of oil is going to go up or go down. And so any oil company in the world that plays a significant role in the global oil marketplace is fair game simply because of the role of oil in our national security. Okay, so all energy companies are on the table, fine. This summer, The Intercept, which is Glenn Greenwald's news organization, published a really fascinating story showing that antivirus companies were being targeted by NSA and GCHQ. So why would antivirus companies be targeted? Well, the first thing is, of course, our government writes malware, and they want to know if foreign AV companies have signatures in the works or whether they are able to detect our malware. And then they also actually see it as a source of free zero days. So if you spy on AV companies, you can get reports of other countries' malware and other countries' 0 days before they're known to the public. So this is, I'm just going to show a couple of slides. If anyone has a security clearance in the room, you might want to avert your eyes for a couple minutes. So this is from an NSA slide deck, using SIGINT to learn about new viruses, so using surveillance to learn about new viruses. This is an email that's included from, this is from a guy called Francois Picard, a Canadian researcher. This is an email that he sent to, I think, a dozen AV companies with an attachment, with an attached piece of malware, a link to a VirusTotal. And so this email somehow ended up in NSA's surveillance dragnet, and then they pulled it out. And it's fascinating because, I mean, this researcher isn't seen to be, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's a legitimate white hat computer security researcher. He finds a piece of malware. I don't know whether one of his customers was targeted, but somehow he stumbles across this piece of malware, and he does the responsible thing, which is he emails a bunch of AV companies. And then because one or more of those antivirus companies are being targeted by NSA, then his communications then get ensnared in that dragnet. So this is the last slide from this deck showing that NSA viewed all of these other companies as targets. I don't know if you guys can see in the back, but there's like companies in Korea and Germany and Austria and Slovakia, like all of the big non-US antivirus companies. All right, but who cares, right? These are foreign companies, and yeah, I guess maybe if you work for a foreign computer security company, either on the offensive or defensive side, you are a threat to US national security, maybe. And then there's, of course, this story. When Glenn Greenwald published his book, he included this photo of what's called the Interdiction Program. I'm going to just zoom in, like CSI. There we go. So it's upside down, obviously, but you can see that logo, right? So under this program, the NSA opens up routers on their way out of the country, pops open the box, reflashes the firmware, and then seals the box up with new tape and then sends it out of the country. And the idea is there are going to be foreign customers who are going to buy US designed and manufactured equipment, and then they're going to place it on internal networks where NSA cannot easily hack into those networks. And so they want to have their surveillance software pre-installed on these boxes. So as you might imagine, when this story was first published, Cisco was not terribly excited to hear the news. This is the letter that the president of Cisco, the CEO of Cisco, wrote to President Obama saying that he was very, very upset. And I think ultimately what Cisco ended up doing was establishing warehouses outside of the United States. So if you're the Saudi government and you want to buy a bunch of routers, now they ship them to you from Brussels instead of from California. And so that obviously has led to increased costs for Cisco. They're having to keep this stuff on hand and has obviously harmed their reputation globally. All right, and then one more sort of interesting story. And to be clear, this wasn't like the NSA hacking into Cisco's data centers or targeting Cisco employees. They were just opening up Cisco products, but it still sort of harmed Cisco. So one of the most interesting stories from I guess, late 2013 was this sort of back and forth where Greenwald and his colleagues alleged that the NSA had impersonated Facebook. And the NSA said, no, we didn't really do that. So this is one of the slides from a program called Quantum. Quantum is one of the more interesting things that NSA does. Essentially, they have a bunch of servers out on the internet. And when a user they want to target tries to access some unencrypted content on the web, NSA's servers respond before the legitimate server responds, and the NSA response gives you a link to malware. And so the idea is they need to be closer to you than the legitimate server of the site you're visiting, and they need to have a faster, lower latency link. So this program is called Quantum, and there's a bunch of versions of Quantum, but the one that's most interesting here is something called Quantum Hand. This exploits the computers of users who are visiting Facebook. And so this is from 2010, before Facebook went HTTPS by default. So at the time, everyone who was using Facebook was getting it in the clear, And so anyone who monkeyed with the traffic on the way to and from Facebook servers could deliver malicious JavaScript to users. So when this story came out, that Facebook was being impersonated by the NSA, Mark Zuckerberg posted something to his Facebook wall, which is what you do when you're the CEO of a company. And he said, in essence, that he was really mad. So Zuckerberg actually called up the president on the phone to explain how mad he was. It's something that I'm not able to do. Or I guess neither could the CEO of Cisco do. But again, I think this sort of demonstrates the extent to which the NSA will go to do what they think their job is. You know, Facebook is not the company with the best reputation in the world. Facebook needs every bit of karma they can get to retain what little trust of their users they have. And so for the NSA to go around impersonating Facebook is pretty nuts. Okay, so the examples I've just given are of NSA sort of targeting foreign people, foreign oil companies, foreign computer security researchers, and then using the reputation or risking harm to the reputation of US companies. And to be clear, NSA probably does more than this, but you know what we have to go on is the stuff that's been published in the Snowden documents. For some reason, the stuff that's been published about GCHQ, the British intelligence agency, is much more revealing. I don't know if that's because GCHQ just doesn't care and does anything they want, or if they just talk about it more in their slides. But one of the most interesting things that I've seen, and you'll see me talk about this more in a bit, is, and there isn't like a sexy term to describe this, but essentially it's hacking to enable surveillance. It's hacking people who themselves are not bad people because they have access to systems that the intelligence agencies want. So I'm going to read you something really boring. This spring, the British government became the first government in the world to publish a code of conduct for government hacking. So to be clear, the British are not the only government in the world that hacks. The US has been doing it, well, the FBI has been doing it for 15 years, and you know, God knows how long the NSA has been doing it. But in response to a lawsuit by one of our sister organizations, a group in the UK sued the British government for hacking, and they said, it's outrageous that you're hacking without a code of conduct. And then, so GCHQ said, okay, well, here's our code of conduct that we just wrote last week. And so I'm going to read you this section from the code of conduct, and it sounds boring, but I'll explain why it's interesting. So this is the code of conduct, quote, where it is proposed to hack individuals who are not intelligence targets in their own right, hacking those individuals should not be considered as collateral intrusion, but rather as intended intrusion. So this is like a really legally way of saying that it's that people who themselves are not bad people are fair game if they have access to systems that the government wants. So normally, you know, when we had the first Snowden story break, right, and we had the news about the fact that the NSA was collecting records of every telephone call in the country, sort of the response from the president and senior US government officials was twofold. One, we're not getting content. It's just metadata. It's really not that sensitive. Like, don't worry about it. And then the second thing was, look, we don't want your data. We're looking for the needle in the haystack, and to find the needle, we need the whole haystack. And this is an argument that I think appealed to many people. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, technically, there's some really sensitive, damning information about me in that database, but they're never gonna look at it because I'm not a bad person. It's sort of incidental over-collection because they're not able to target the bad people because they don't know who the bad people are yet. And so that kind of untargeted surveillance or the sort of collateral damage of surveillance is very similar to what we see in traditional wars, right? So you drop a bomb on the place where the bad guys are, and there's a school next door, and you say, oh, you know, we weren't targeting that school. The people that we killed, you know, they weren't the intended targets, but, you know, shit happens in war, and we'll next time we'll try much better to target the bombs. What I want to be clear about is the thing I'm now going to be discussing isn't collateral damage. This is not the government accidentally hacking the wrong people. These are situations where governments are systematically targeting people who are not bad people themselves. So, the first example I'm going to use is a story about a company called Gemalto. Show of hands, who's heard of Gemalto before? All right, so they're a Dutch-French manufacturer of SIM cards. They're the largest manufacturer of SIM cards in the world. If you have a US passport and you got it in the last, 8 or 9 years, and you have one of those little RFID antennas, they manufacture the antenna and the chip inside there. And if you're a US government employee and you have a CAT card or a PIV card, they manufacture your card. They are the largest manufacturer of smart cards in the world. And so it turns out that over the last decade or so, many phone networks around the world have moved from insecure, easily tappable 2G protocols to more secure, slightly better encrypted 3G and 4G protocols. And so now there's an encrypted link between your phone and the cell tower that you're talking to. And to be able to intercept those calls, governments increasingly need the keys that encrypt those calls. So there's three copies of the key. There's one copy on your SIM card. There's another copy on a server run by your phone company. And then it turned out there was a third copy of that key held by Gemalto, the company that made the SIM cards. So I think the reason for this is that SIM cards are really, really cheap, really, really cheap, like 50 cents or less. They're manufactured a million at a time. And when AT&T wants a million SIM cards, they place an order, Gemalto manufactures them, they send them over on a shipping container, and then they email a spreadsheet to AT&T with those SIM card encryption keys. And then this is real, like they FTP it. And so here's the thing, like Gemalto wants to keep a copy because what if they lose the spreadsheet? You don't want to have a million SIM cards that can no longer be used. So they keep a copy of that SIM card database around just in case the customer loses it. And so this spring, The Intercept revealed that the British intelligence agency GCHQ had hacked Gemalto in order to spy on and intercept telephone calls in places like Somalia, where Al-Shabaab is like a pretty serious terrorist organization. I'm not going to say that the US doesn't have an interest in listening to telephone calls in Somalia, but it turns out that many Somali networks use 3G and LTE. So that means telephone calls there are encrypted. And so the easiest thing for the US and the British to do, is to set up a bunch of antennas around Somalia and passively receive these encrypted calls and then decrypt the calls with these keys. But to decrypt the calls, you need the keys. And so what they did is they hacked Gemalto. So that's sort of interesting from a security of telecommunications networks perspective. But this is a room of sysadmins. So why am I talking about this? All right, so I'm going to read you some things from the story. GCHQ secretly cyber-stalked Gemalto employees, scouring their emails in an effort to find people who may have had access to the company's core networks and encryption key generating systems. They cyber-stalked the employees. GCHQ operatives identified key individuals and their positions within Gemalto and then dug into their emails. In one instance, GCHQ zeroed in on a Gemalto employee in Thailand who they observed sending PGP encrypted files, noting that if GCHQ wanted to expand its Gemalto operations, he would certainly be a good place to start. To be clear, they didn't know what he was sending, but they figured if he was using PGP, he was probably sending something interesting and thus worthy of more attention. The story added that the cyberstalking was not limited to Gemalto, and that GCHQ assigned scores to more than 150 individual email addresses based on how often the users mentioned certain technical terms and then intensified the mining of those individuals' accounts based on priority. So if you were an employee at Gemalto or Ericsson or one of these other carrier device manufacturers, and your emails to your colleagues included terms that suggested that you really knew a lot about, the backhauls and telephone networking equipment, suddenly you're on their list. And then if you're sending PGP encrypted emails, well, then you really have something of value, so let's target you. So as part of these operations, GCHQ operatives acquired the usernames and passwords for Facebook accounts of Gemalto targets. This is not about work activity then, right? If they're looking for your Facebook usernames and passwords, they're also looking at what you're doing at home. And I think, you know, as I said at the beginning of this talk, I think many of us feel like our security obligations begin and end from 9 to 6, or whatever hours you guys work. But the people who are going to try to attack you, they don't care about the 9 to 5 or the 9 to 6. If they can get you at 2 in the morning on a Sunday when you're logging into your Facebook account, that's fine. They'll hang out on your system, and then when you go to work on Monday, then they'll spread from your personal laptop or the work laptop you brought home to your corporate system. So that was the Gemalto hack. One of the more interesting ones, I think. Last year, the same reporters at The Intercept published an in-depth analysis of something called Operation Socialist, which was a report on how GCHQ hacked into Belgacom. Belgacom being Belgium's largest phone network, but also a major backhaul provider for many other operators. According to The Intercept, the malware found in Belgacom's systems was one of the most advanced spy tools ever identified by security researchers, who named it Region. So this is from some of the GCHQ slides. I'm going to zoom in a second, but so what? One of the things they did is they wanted to identify the people who worked in NOCs, Network Operations Centers. They had a specific interest in people who worked on maintenance or security. And then the selectors, which is like the search terms that they use to target their hacking, worked either, the things that they used to trigger were either people using LinkedIn or people visiting Slashdot. And presumably, I mean, this is like 5 years old, so presumably there are other sites that they would use now. So they also had this program where they systematically and automatically detected knocks based on usage of certain technologies and certain characteristics. And then this slide says, once they had the IP ranges of these knocks, they would then select the NOC staff to enable quantum insert. Quantum insert is this man-in-the-middle attack against them. So what I'm showing here, these are GCHQ slides talking about how they were systematically targeting the engineers who worked in NOCs. And I want to be clear about something, right? So whether it's the Belgacom hack or the Gemalto hack or one of these others that I'm going to talk about afterwards, these are not terrorists. These are not drug dealers. They're not pedophiles. When you think of the kinds of bad guys that are described to the public to justify what intelligence agencies do, right? I'm perfectly okay with the government hacking into the computers of foreign leaders. That's fine. Like, foreign leaders are fair game. They have their own intelligence agencies who are there to protect them. I'm perfectly fine with governments spying on really bad drug dealers and pedophiles and terrorists. Like, go for it. But that's the story we've been told about why we need these intelligence agencies. And then what does it turn out they're doing behind the scenes? They're targeting regular people who have husbands and wives and kids and dogs and sometimes cats. These are decent people. There's no evidence that the engineers at Gemalto or the people who worked in these NOCs are bad people. They're regular, decent people who happen, because of their jobs, their systems are interesting enough, and they are a means to an end. And as someone who comes from this world, as someone who used to be, like, I worked in a SOC, in the Security Operations Center for a company that managed Belgium's identity database, like their national ID system, which I would have been a totally legitimate target when I was 1 year out of college, right? And this bothers me because, you know, when you're at that recruiting fair in college and, you know, there are these companies saying, oh, come and work for us and do this. And, you know, there's a company doing the video games and they say, oh, you can play all these video games for free. And there's Google and they say, oh, come here. We have these smoothies and massages. And you're like trying to pick which career you go down. And the sysadmin stuff like sounds really fun, Nowhere when I was signing up to be a sysadmin did someone say, oh, and by the way, you're now fair game for the biggest intelligence agencies in the world. But we are, and you are. Going on, these documents say that that they named three male Belgacom engineers who were identified as targets to attack. And again, these weren't people who they thought were bad. They were just thought they were an in to Belgacom systems. And then GCHQ monitored the web browsing habits of the engineers, geared up to enter the most sensitive and important phase of the operation. They set up a malicious page that looked like LinkedIn to trick the engineers. They sent them, you know, those annoying LinkedIn emails that we all get. And then when they clicked on those links, they delivered malware to their computers. So what does this mean? Does this mean that clicking on LinkedIn links is dangerous behavior? Well, yes. Does this mean you should ban LinkedIn from your corporate networks? Well, probably. But what I think it also means and shows is that not only are you fair game, but to get at you, they will use the full arsenal of tools they have. So here we have them using both malware and signals intelligence. They collect all these emails that are going in plain text over the internet. They're collecting all the web browsing that's going over HTTP, and then they look through that. Well, you know, which pages do these engineers go to? What search terms have they searched for? Where on the web are we most likely to be successful in hacking them? And then, quote, by adding the malware on the engineers' computers, the spies had gained control of their machines and were able to exploit the broad access the engineers had into the networks for surveillance purposes, making it clear that these engineers were not the targets. They were just a means into Belgacom systems. Okay, just a couple more. Last year, Der Spiegel and The Intercept published a story about how several of Germany's largest satellite internet operators, so companies that provide internet service in places in Africa, had been hacked. The documents list central employees at the company and stated that they should be identified and tasked. This included the CEO of Stellar, which is one of these satellite companies, and nine other employees. All right, and then one of the most interesting stories, how many people in this room have heard of the Athens affair? This is like one of the coolest and scariest stories from the last few years. So essentially, 2004, Greece holds the Olympics. Everyone, it's just a few years after 9/11, so everyone's like really, really worried about terrorism. And so the Greeks invite the Americans in to help them with security. And included in that, they invited the NSA in to help them with signals intelligence. A few months after the Olympics are over, a engineer working for Vodafone Greece, Greece's largest phone company, commits suicide under really mysterious circumstances. Then it turns out that they're like the Greeks are investigating and looking at the equipment that he'd set up, and they find that the wiretapping feature in the equipment that the Greeks hadn't paid for had been turned on, and someone had installed a license key, and then had used the lawful interception features in the telephone switches to tap the phones of the Greek prime minister and members of the Greek cabinet. So like all of the top people in the Greek government were being secretly tapped, and the calls were basically being sent back to the NSA. So this was a huge, huge scandal in Greece. And like bits and pieces of it have been coming out over the last few years. You know, I think it's an interesting story. There's a movie called Field of Dreams. I assume most people have seen Field of Dreams. What's the cheesy line in Field of Dreams? If you build it, they will come, right? And so that's actually like the mantra of surveillance, which is if you build a surveillance feature into your network, at some point someone's going to use it, and that might not be you. And in this case, there was a surveillance feature built into the core telephone switches in Vodafone's network, and then someone else turned it on, in this case, NSA. So James Bamford, who's probably the best NSA historian, did a big story with The Intercept just a few months ago where he went to Greece and interviewed like the brother of the engineer who killed himself. And there are a few anecdotes in that story that I think are really powerful. Quote, in fact, recruiting a foreign telecom employee as an inside person for a major operation was standard operating procedure for both the NSA and the CIA. Quote, what the NSA really doesn't like to admit is about 70% of NSA's exploitation is human-enabled. What Bamford is saying here, and he's actually quoting an ex-CIA official describing this, is that it's much easier to bribe or blackmail or somehow gain influence over an engineer and get that engineer to, you know, install a thumb drive and a piece of equipment or type a few commands at a keyboard than it is to hack that equipment over the network. When I saw this number, 70% of NSA's exploitation is human-enabled, I was blown away. Right, so in this case, the operation ended with the suicide of an engineer, or the mysterious suicide of an engineer, which is tragic in so many ways. But the reason I bring this up is, you know, what this anecdote tells me is that you don't just have to worry about people hacking into your computers. You have to worry about blackmail. Now maybe, you know, or bribery. Maybe if the idea of someone offering you a briefcase full of cash or lots of drugs sounds nice. But, you know, that briefcase full of cash and the drugs and the attractive men or women who meet you in the hotel bar, like, they're there for a reason. And they're going to want something from you. And it's not going to be good. The same story adds, covertly recruiting employees in foreign telecom companies has long been one of the NSA's deepest secrets. And you understand why, right? Like, once a telco suspects that they have a mole on the inside, then they start looking for that person, and it becomes increasingly difficult for that person to stay secret. So I don't want you to come away from this presentation feeling like, oh, you know, I saw this keynote from this guy at the ACLU, and all he did was complain about the NSA and the British. Like, I'm not here to say that one country is better than another. I'm not here to say that the NSA is more aggressive than any other intelligence service, or that the British have the weakest laws that allow the most surveillance, although I think that is probably the case for the UK. The reason I'm talking about the UK and the NSA is because we have the Snowden documents. That's it. If there had been a Chinese Snowden or a Russian Snowden, I'd be up here talking about how the Russians systematically are hacking US engineers and stalking them. If we had a Chinese Snowden, I'd be up here talking about how the Chinese government bribes and blackmails engineers into installing malicious software on their employers' networks. But I don't have the Chinese Snowden documents. I don't have the Russian Snowden documents. I don't have the Israeli Snowden documents. But to be clear, those documents all exist, and those governments are doing the same thing as ours. We just don't have the smoking gun. In 2009, for example, in early 2010, Google revealed that the previous year they had been hacked by the Chinese, and it wasn't until 2013 that the Washington Post revealed that it had been Google's surveillance team that had been hacked. There's a dedicated team of employees at Google who do nothing but respond to surveillance requests, legitimate, lawful surveillance requests from governments around the world. And this team, which was all running Windows, someone on the team got a phishing email with I think it was either a Flash or Java exploit. And then from there, they were able to access the database of intercepts. And so this was the Chinese did this because they wanted to know which of their agents the US government was monitoring. And the Chinese couldn't just call up the FBI and say, hey, so, you know, who are you spying on? So they hacked Google and found out that way. In that same story, it was revealed that Microsoft's surveillance team had gotten hacked. Then it turns out Microsoft's surveillance team got hacked 3 years later by the Syrian Electronic Army, who are obviously less sophisticated than the Chinese government. What it shows you is that, you know, the surveillance teams at these companies are also fair game. Back in 2011, RSA was hacked very famously. I don't know how many of you guys can see this in the back, but this is actually the phishing email that successfully led to the hack. I'm going to read you it. The subject line is 2011 recruitment plan, and then the text of the email is, I forward this file to you for review, period. Please open and view it, period. Seems pretty easy. So RSA, like Gemalto, had been keeping backup copies of the seeds for their tokens. And once RSA had been hacked, those seeds were then used to break into the networks of several RSA customers, I think mainly defense contractors in the DC area. Right? So I don't know who the target was, whether it was a secretary or a sysadmin. It was accounting. It was the accounting department at RSA. Right? So the accounting department at RSA was targeted by probably a very, very sophisticated agency, even though they didn't need to use particularly sophisticated capabilities here. And so what this means then, and I hope that my scary words for you today have sort of really hit this home, is that your targets, whether you like it or not, whether or not you have boring lives, whether or not your computer only contains episodes of Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine, and photos of your cats, you are legitimate targets in the eyes of most, if not all, of the well-resourced intelligence agencies in the world. And they won't restrict their hacking of you to your work computer or your work email address. They will look at your personal email address and your personal computer and your personal cell phone and your personal web browsing. If they can find something in your personal web browsing that gives them leverage for blackmail, you're fair game. I also want to emphasize that the attackers who might target you have budgets in the billions, billions with a B, and access to all unencrypted data going over the internet. Right? Resources and the means and the access. These are really, really powerful adversaries. So that means that you guys have to shift your tactics if you don't want to be the conduit through which your employer gets hacked. That means that you cannot be sending data over the clear anymore. You cannot be opening up random PDF files and Excel spreadsheets and Word documents. And if you are going to open them, they need to be opened in a VM on a computer that doesn't have access to your SSH credentials or your PGP keys. Right? This doesn't work anymore. And it didn't work 10 years ago, but you didn't really have the evidence before you. Now you can see that engineers and system administrators and accounting departments and legal teams are all fair game. And it's no longer enough to say, well, I'm not breaking any laws, I have nothing to worry about. Now the question is your company doing anything interesting? And could your computer be used as a way into your employer's network? And so to conclude, even if you have nothing to hide, you're still useful. You're still a likely target. And that means you need to up your game. It means you need to do what I did, which is, encrypt your data, switch to a password manager, stop opening up any content over unencrypted links. It means being paranoid 24/7 instead of just the 8 hours a day that you're at work. Thank you very much. So I think I have like 20 minutes, maybe a little bit more for questions. There are microphones in the aisles if you can line up and ask your questions. Also, if the questions can end in a question mark and not take 5 minutes to ask, the organizers said that I should ask for that. So on this side.
Yeah, hi, I'm Rick Farrow, and I really liked your talk a lot. I would like you to comment on how Edward Snowden ended his part of the interview that appeared on Frontline about a month ago. He was specifically, what he said that I really loved was that we can either focus on offense or defense and not both. And just to take this and bring it to the audience just a little bit more, one of my favorite things at the end of his Snowden documents came out was that the NSA had figured out how to hack hard drives. So when you booted your hard drive, it would be booting you into a VM. Okay, and you would not be able to detect this because this is done at the hardware level. When I asked a hard drive manufacturer if they had fixed this, because this is 5 years ago, they said, oh, sure, we're using signatures. Then I found a paper by German researchers from 3 years ago saying they could still do this. Anyway, tell me about offense and defense, if you would.
So that's a great question. I learned a new term shortly after the Snowden documents came out. The term is NOBUS, and it's an abbreviation of a few words. It's nobody but us. Mm. And so in NSA land, what they have this calculus that they engage in where if they find a bug and they think that there's a strong likelihood that someone else might exploit it against the U.S., in particular against the U.S. government, then they will disclose that bug to the affected vendors and get it fixed. But the best bug for them is one that only they have and that only they could ever exploit. And so that, like, in their mind, like, the gold standard for a NOBUS vulnerability is the alleged backdoor in the random number generator that NIST cooked up, where you needed to have an encryption key that only NSA had to be able to predict the output of the random number generator. In their eyes, that's perfect, because it can be sitting there for 20 years and no one else can exploit it. And still right now, the best that the research community has said is, we think this algorithm's cooked, this is how someone might do it, but they cannot prove it because they don't have the underlying key. You know, this debate over whether you prioritize offense or you prioritize defense has really been heating up over the last few years, in part because NSA is no longer the only hacking outfit in the US government. So on the intelligence side, you have a dedicated hacking team at the CIA, you have a dedicated hacking team at NSA, which is called Tailored Access Operations, which is a fairly big part of NSA now. And then JSOC, the special forces, the people who fly the drones and do, you know, the SEAL Team 6 stuff, they also have their own hacking team. So there's like three main hacking teams within the intelligence community. And then
Department of Treasury had a hacker working for them in 1995.
Okay, Treasury. So I was going to say, and then law enforcement have their own hacking. So the FBI has people, the DEA, we know, has purchased software from the Italian company Hacking Team. And so, you know, as these hacking techniques trickle down from the elite part of the IC, the intelligence community, to first federal law enforcement and then state law enforcement, you have this key question, which is, how are they going to get their stuff onto your computer? And phishing doesn't always work. It's surprisingly effective, particularly against RSA, but it doesn't always work. And so how do you get onto the computers of targets who would hopefully not open a malicious link? Well, then you need, you know, a drive-by browser exploit, or you need some other capability. And so this is where we're at now, where you have law enforcement saying, the threat that they face from people using encryption is so great, they need to have ways to access encrypted data. And then those of us in the computer security community saying, well, hang on a second, we don't trust that you won't lose that method of access. We don't trust that you won't get hacked. And we think that we should be prioritizing defense over offense. That's really sort of where Snowden is going. I think there are people in the intelligence community who think they can have it all. They think they can have their cake and eat it too, in that they think they can keep US systems secure and hack everyone else, or at least they think they can keep the most sensitive US system secure while leaving the rest open to foreign nation states.
All right, thank you.
Over there on the side.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. I wish I could say that I was surprised at what the NSA was doing. Instead, I have to admit that I'm impressed by the degree of sophistication, breadth, and depth of their deviousness. It's really impressive. I've always maintained that I've had no secrets, and now I am certain that I have no secrets. But I believe you misinterpreted the code of conduct, and I'm curious what you think about that. I read it as, if you're going to spy on an individual, you're acknowledging that they are directly being spied on and not collateral. It is a moral statement that you know what you're doing if you go after an individual. Doesn't make it right, it just means that if you're an intelligence officer, you understand that you are looking at a person, they're not collateral.
So to expand on that British code of conduct, my friends at Privacy International are suing GCHQ. As I said, the code of conduct was in response to their lawsuit. I've had numerous conversations with British government officials about this sort of enabling surveillance. You're right that that code of conduct in that paragraph are describing, you know, make sure that you're treating this kind of hacking as A and not B. But this is the first and only acknowledgement from the British government that they even do this kind of hacking. And so the only reason that I'm not talking about the ethics of it there. I'm just saying we don't have anything equivalent in the US where NSA even acknowledges that not bad people can be legitimate targets, whereas the Brits are at least a little bit upfront about it.
I think the NSA is saying we want it all and we're allowed to have it.
Maybe. Well, they're not saying it, they're just doing it. Okay, on this side.
So it's probably too late for me and probably too late for at least some other people. You know, I'm running an NSA laptop over there. What do you do after, you know, if I've sort of seen the light here, what can I do to protect myself and my company?
So what can you do? You know, when the Snowden stories first came out, particularly like the first one with the Verizon metadata database, I thought, okay, what's going to be the impact of these stories? You know, maybe we'll get a few changes to some laws, but largely the political ramifications have been minor. There have been really small tweaks to U.S. law, but for the most part, NSA is still doing what they were doing before the Snowden stories came out. And the more time has gone on, I've become convinced that the biggest long-term impact from the Snowden stories is not going to be in Congress or in the courts, but actually in the computer science community. I think there, before Snowden, I think there was a tendency, particularly, you know, with the standards that come out of the IETF and W3C and other engineering organizations, you know, you'd have these designs by committee, and there'd be a protocol that would come out, and everyone wanted to compromise, so there'd be like 30 configuration options. So these protocols were far too complex. The default settings would not be secure because there'd be someone saying, oh, we want to implement this on an embedded system and we're going to have a low speed processor, so let's have 40-bit encryption as a default, or something like that. You know, the gentleman over here was right. Like, a lot of what has come out, you know, you look at this and say, man, that's really impressive. From an engineering and computer science perspective, like, good for you, NSA. Like that's pretty cool. And the fact is, you know, if you give the smartest engineers in the country $10 billion, they're going to come up with some cool things. But also, yes, they have been innovative. Yes, they have done some interesting things. But they've also harvested a hell of a lot of low-hanging fruit. And I think that the computer science community has done a really bad job over the past 20 or 30 years of allowing all that low-hanging fruit to sit on the tree and rot. And we had protocols that were past their sell-by date. We were introducing new protocols that still were not secure by default. And I think, you know, those Snowden stories really proved to be a wake-up call for the community that develops protocols and standards. And I think now we're going to start seeing, you know, TLS 1.3 with only secure, you know, algorithmic options. We're only going to have secure default settings. You know, I think the reason why we have David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, and President Obama, and the FBI Director, and all these government officials complaining about end-to-end encryption is we're finally delivering encryption in a usable way to users after 30 years of giving people PGP and then being surprised when they can't figure out how to use it. So I think, you know, post-Snowden, what we've seen is a radicalization of the engineering community. And we're finally starting to deliver products and applications and protocols that are secure by default. So, to answer your question, what can you do? I think the first thing is to start using modern technology. You know, I've been really excited. How many people in this room have downloaded and tried to use the program Signal on their smartphone? Okay, so Signal is, if you haven't tried it, it's really cool. It's one of the first usable, highly secure apps for encrypted text messaging and encrypted voice calls. It's free. The voice component uses ZRTP, a protocol designed by Phil Zimmerman, the guy behind PGP. And then the text component uses a protocol called Axolotl, which was designed by Trevor Perrin and Moxie Marlinspike. It's had numerous audits. It's open source. It's really, really good, and it's actually subsidized by the State Department, because we want to allow dissidents in Iran and China to communicate. So I've basically given up on PGP. I've stopped recommending it to new users. I think it's too easy to shoot yourself in the foot. But when I see tools like Signal, or I see Apple with FaceTime, although iMessage backs up things by default, unencrypted to Apple servers, when I see WhatsApp rolling out Axolotl as well, I see a future where at least our voice and text communications are going to be encrypted. I don't know how to hide metadata yet, and I don't think anyone else really has figured out how to do that reliably. But so the first thing is, let's embrace the security tools we know work. The next thing is, we need to kill plain text on the internet. Everything needs to be encrypted, and the IETF is moving in this direction. I've spent the last 5 years begging and pleading and harassing companies to switch to TLS on their web servers and then start TLS on their email servers. And I know start TLS isn't perfect and it's easily man-in-the-middleable, but at least it protects you against passive adversaries. I think we need to use the crypto where we can. And then, you know, there are some really exciting projects right now intended to make penetration-resistant operating systems. So the two most exciting things are Qubes and Subgraph. Qubes, for those of you who don't know, you have like these VMs for every different program on your computer. And so when you open an attachment, it fires up a new VM, it displays the PDF, and then when you're done, the VM gets destroyed and you're back to where you were. And so you can actually have a usable email client there where your PDF isn't being opened in the same VM that's storing your PGP encryption keys. And so right now I'd say, you know, if you want to tinker on the weekend, download Qubes and try it out. And then I guess the last thing I'll say is about this, you know, how many of you saw the Washington Post story last week about the lack of concern for security in the Linux kernel community? Some people, right? So we've had 15 years of efforts by the GR security and PAX teams to develop technologies that will allow the kernel to protect itself. And there's a cultural divide between the security community and the kernel team. I think, you know, the kernel people care about performance and not breaking user space. And the security people are willing to break anything and take any performance hit to keep a system secure. And those sides don't see eye to eye. My hope is that story, I mean, a front page story in one of the nation's biggest newspapers about the kernel team is like it's a pretty big deal. My hope is that will push people in the right direction. We, you know, when I started using Linux when I was 12, I did it because Windows was a joke. Windows was unstable. Windows was insecure. Windows viruses were, you know, a constant threat. And I used Linux at the time because it was more stable, more secure, and ran on older hardware in a great way. And the fact is that after Gates sent out that memo and forced all the Microsoft engineers to learn about security, and they created the, you know, the security lifecycle, and they hired a bunch of great people, both internally and as penetration testers, Microsoft got serious about security. And I think Linux has lagged behind, and I think the Linux community needs to shake itself into realizing that a 5% performance hit is probably worth it if we can get back to where we were in terms of people being proud of the security of Linux. And it's not there now, but I hope it will be at some point. On the side.
Sure. What I learned from the LavaBit case was that the government can compel you to give up some information, and they can also compel you to not tell anyone that they told you to give up the information. So as a sysadmin, do I need, like, should we all go back to our offices and put the sign on the wall that says, like, the government has not yet asked me for any information? Is that a useful thing to do?
So the LavaBit case, has everyone in the room heard of the LavaBit case? Most people? Some? Okay. This was a Texan small company that was delivering secure email. Snowden was one of their users. The day after Snowden's LavaBit email address was published by one of the news organizations, they received a court order to enable metadata surveillance of Snowden's account. They said, sorry, everything's encrypted on our servers, so we're not able to target just Snowden's email account. So the government came back and said, that's fine, just give us your HTTPS encryption key, and then we'll do the monitoring for you. We'll sift it out of the 400,000 other users' traffic you have. So the Lavabit CEO, Ladar Levinson, he didn't want to turn over his encryption key. The government got a court order forcing him to turn over his encryption key. He did two things that were not that smart. The first is when the FBI knocked on his front door, he ran out the back door. So I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice, but I don't recommend doing that. And then when the court did provide him with that order compelling him to give the encryption key to the government, he printed it out in four-point font and then faxed it to the government. So that's sort of like paying your taxes in pennies. It's not, you want to be sympathetic in the eyes of the court, right? And so, you know, what had happened is Ladar had built an email service that was secure against the threats that were in his mind, in his threat model, in 2001, 2002, when he designed the system, which was passive adversaries who spy on the network. He never built the service against an adversary that could come and twist his arm and say, do this or else. And it turns out designing a service against an adversary that has pseudo power over you is really hard, really, really hard. And you know, my hope is that that episode will inspire a generation of new research for how to design systems that the sysadmins themselves cannot compromise, of course, to do so. You know, I think what we're seeing now, particularly as big companies like Apple and WhatsApp start offering end-to-end encryption to their users, and law enforcement are figuring out that they can no longer wiretap phone calls and text messages, we're going to see this conflict point, right, where law enforcement increasingly wants to hack endpoints to do surveillance they could do in the past but cannot do anymore. And they look around and they see that Microsoft and Google and Apple all have the ability to push code to your devices, right? The auto-update features in our operating systems, which are good. Like, we want automatic updates because it means that users run up-to-date secure code. But I think governments are increasingly looking at those auto-update services and saying, oh, wait, that's a vehicle for getting our surveillance software onto the device of the target. And of course, those companies don't want their update services to be used. But the Lavabit case and a couple others that have come out recently really raise the question of how far can the government go in compelling a third party to enable surveillance of their customers. And we don't know the answer to that right now. And the unfortunate thing is, when we get the answer, it'll probably come out of a sealed court case where only the government gets to talk to the court. So does that mean that you should post a warrant canary on your door? Well, that warrant canary is only useful if people are walking by your door. And so, you know, there are a number of companies that have posted warrant canaries. The best canary to date is from a company called Cloudflare, who say their canary, including saying, you know, we haven't received orders for all of our users' data, says we haven't received any orders for our encryption keys. That is the thing that scares me the most. You know, but if you're going to post a notice somewhere, it's, again, I'm not a lawyer, this is not legal advice, but it's better to put it on the web where everyone can see it than just on your door. Sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. So on the average sysadmin in home, wife, 1 3/4 kids, a dog, maybe a cat, and I happen to maybe have a transparent logging firewall or something like that, right? Is there anything that like I can look at, you know, aside from the normal sort of malware, botnet stuff, antivirus that all of them look at, but is there any sort of traffic pattern that I can look at to let me know, hey, somebody's got some sort of spying connection open on me?
I mean, it's tough, right? I'm coming here saying, hey guys, you gotta protect yourselves, when in fact, it's really hard to protect yourself from a $10 billion intelligence agency. And the fact is that NSA's malware doesn't make a connection back to Fort Meade. Right, you can't grep NSA.gov in your log files.
Yeah.
You know, they actually take over botnets and then use those botnets for their own means. And so, I mean, it looks just like if you can find it, it looks like, you know, any hacker. you know, if they really want you, they're going to get you. There's no real way around that. If they really, really, really want you, they're going to get you. If they have to burn, you know, $1 million O-Day in iOS, they'll do it. They don't care. For the right target, it's worth it. But you can make it more expensive for them. You know, there's this old joke. It's really cheesy, right? It's like, you know, you're out in the woods with one of your friends on a hunting trip, and you see a bear, right? You don't have to outrun the bear. You just outrun your friends. And you just need to be more secure than every other sysadmin at your organization. And then it's their problem. I think you can make it more difficult for them. You can make yourself a harder target. It's unlikely that you're going to see something in your firewall that easily that is obvious. I think what you can do is, you know, I think there's been this approach in for the last 20 years, which is let's just build a really big wall and keep out the barbarians, and then. As more and more companies have gotten hacked, there's been this awareness that, okay, it's actually not about keeping the bad guy out because the bad guy's probably already in our system. So it's about surviving that and minimizing the damage and then speeding up the rate at which we can discover it and kick them out. And I think many big enterprises are following that philosophy now, but very few individuals are. And so from an individual perspective, you should be thinking, okay, if I do get hacked, how do I recover? How do I minimize the harm? You know, can I design my own working environment in such a way that one successful compromise of my system doesn't lead to the catastrophic loss of all of my encryption keys or all the credentials I have? Hopefully that helps.
Thanks.
Let's see how we're doing on time. Yeah, we're fine. Go ahead.
So Chris, when I'm looking at your slides, I'm getting a sense of deja vu. I used to work at a defense contractor, and we used to do information security awareness for the employees, et cetera. Now, the narrative there was always the advanced persistence threat. It's the other guys that are doing this to us. So I am curious if you've seen any similar security awareness type stuff from other DC area contractors where we're giving advice to people on how to protect themselves. It was the same thing. Hey, you have privileged information. You're a person of interest. Doesn't matter how boring your life is, etc. Things to be gleaned there because it's all tradecraft.
So, who in the room got one of the post OPM? Sorry, we got hacked and lost your data to China. Emails or letters. So, how many feds in the room, or one-time feds? So Office of Personnel Management gets hacked, like biggest breach of federal employee data ever. And then what do? They sign you up for credit monitoring from some sketchy company. The email that they send to federal employees doesn't come from a gov email address. It asks you to go to an unencrypted web link where you're then asked to enter your social security number. So to their credit, the Pentagon was the only part of the government that shut it down and said, we are not going to allow these emails into our network. They're too scary. They look bad, and they're training our employees to do bad things. You know, I don't have a good answer for your question about, you know, are defense contractors and other parts of the government reluctant to give good training for fear of revealing tradecraft when the things that they're doing for legitimate reasons are often so inept. You know, I think we have an imbalance throughout the industry, but particularly in the government, where the offensive folks are really, really good, and the defensive folks are really, really bad. And I think in part that's because the offensive stuff is sexy and it's exciting, and the defensive stuff is boring. And I don't know. I don't know why we have that imbalance. But, you know, typically, there are many people who work in the US government who, when they leave, can go and get a job in the private sector easily. But often, you're not wanted for your technical skills. You're wanted for your ability to call your old colleagues and sell the product, right? If you are the CIO at the Department of Veterans Affairs, you can easily get a job when you leave, but that's because everyone wants your help in selling products back to the VA. Most parts of the government, although 18F and the US Digital Service are like bright spots in the government, but most parts of the government are not seen as excelling in IT. But the NSA is different. The NSA actually is amazing at what they do on the offensive side. And We need to do a better job about defense. And I think, you know, as was asked in this question earlier, we prioritize offense as a country. And as long as we're prioritizing offense, I think the training we give to people for defense is going to be lackluster at best. Over there.
Have we technically already lost this fight if the best we can do is slow them down? Like, should the place we be trying to fight it be somewhere else, like the courts, the voting booth, that kind of thing? Or do you think technology is still the best bet for protection?
So if you ask a fish what it's thinking about, it'll say the water. And so I work for a legal organization. My colleagues are the lawyers who sue the NSA. My lobbyists are the ones who are, you know, pushing Congress to pass new laws to protect our privacy. But I come from a background in technology, right? And so I think that technology has the power to change the world in ways that the law and the courts cannot. What I like about technology, yeah, technology is awesome. What I like about technology is the courts can get it wrong, and Congress can be corrupt, and I still get encrypted end-to-end communications, right? I love the fact that you know, the FBI director stands up on stage and wags his finger, and the British government is talking about passing horrible new legislation, but I can still encrypt my device and encrypt my communications. I can protect myself where the courts have not stepped in and where the executive branch has lied and twisted the law to allow surveillance that is simply crazy in its scope. So, you know, I love technology. I think that technology can keep us safe, can protect us, and protect our privacy. But that means that this community needs to actually deliver good technology. And for far too long, we have delivered technology that was not secure by default, was difficult to use, and used out-of-date crypto. And so while technology can save us, only good technology can save us. And so that's why I spend so much of my time pushing tech companies to improve the products and improve the features that are built into their products. I think I have time for, I guess, I can do both. Yeah.
So given that we are, if they want us, they will get us, as you said earlier, and we are inexorably doomed, sort of, how do we keep hope?
How do you keep hope? So I think the first thing to understand is that not all adversaries have the same resources. So I view surveillance in many ways in economic terms. Right? So surveillance used to be really expensive for the government. If the FBI wanted to track your movements in the 1970s, they'd have to put a team of agents on your tail. Right? The FBI uses this thing called a floating box, where they have a couple guys in the front, a couple guys in the back, and the box sort of moves around you. And that isn't just four people, like, because you look in your rearview mirror, if you see the same car over and over and over again, you know something's up. So they have to swap out cars, people need bathroom breaks, people only work, you know, 8 or 10 hours a day. And so it took a huge amount of resources to do 24-hour physical surveillance of someone in the 1970s. Fast forward 40 years, and we have cell phones in our pockets that can be pinged whenever the government asks the phone companies to do it. The cost of surveillance has dropped through the floor to the point that now a single police officer from their desk can track hundreds or thousands of people. And so my concern is that surveillance has gotten too cheap. You know, Chris Rock, the comedian, has this sketch that he does where he talks about his views on guns. And to be clear, I'm not talking about my views on guns here. It's a very sensitive topic for many people. But Chris talks about his views on guns, where he says that he thinks that guns should be legal, but bullets should cost $1 million each. Right? Where he thinks that, okay, if you're going to shoot someone, that person needs to really be important. They need to be worth that $1 million. And I sort of view surveillance in that way, too. Right? So pre-Snowden, when you look at the Snowden documents that have come out, what's clear is that in, you know, the 2008 to 2011 time period, the biggest problem for GCHQ and NSA was in consuming and sorting the bulk data they were intercepting. You know, you look in 2009, not a single major cloud computing, social network, or email provider was using encryption. And so all they had to do was just, you know, sit on the backbone and dip their net in and just take stuff out. And then in 2010, Google turned on HTTPS by default, and over the next few years, Twitter and Facebook and Yahoo and Microsoft all followed. And at this point, I mean, just this summer, the White House announced that by the end of next year, every US government website will be encrypted by default too. HTTPS is becoming the norm. And when you look at the impact of that, you know, there's a reason that Comey, the FBI director, is complaining about encryption. It's because it's finally being used. And when you force the government from passive to active, you raise the cost of surveillance. If they have to deliver malware to your box instead of spying on the network, they have to do more work, they're more likely to get caught, and they can do it to less people. If you force them to go from an active network attacker to a black bag attacker breaking into your hotel room, you raise the cost even more. And so, yes, if they really, really want you, they will get you. But let's make it as expensive as possible so that they have to pick and choose who they really care about, because right now, surveillance is too damn cheap. All right. I'm afraid this is the last question. Sorry, sir.
So you talk about your hope is that the security protocols are going to become better and that we're all going to move to the new glorious future where everyone is using security by default. So at least at my company, we have to cater to a lot of people who aren't on the cutting edge, who don't necessarily have the economic means to be on the cutting edge. And if what you're talking about is security by default at the other end, how do we get those people there with us? Because otherwise, they're going to hold us back.
That's an excellent question, right? I mean, how long should your organization have to support Windows XP if the cost of Windows XP means that you cannot support modern encryption? So, you know, as an example, Windows XP and the versions of Internet Explorer, I think up till 8, don't support something called SNI, which is a feature that allows multiple HTTPS websites to use the same IP address. Because there are these Windows XP computers out there that demand a single IP address for every encrypted site, it means that organizations that want to turn on encryption right now, in addition to buying a certificate, which is becoming free basically, they need to get an IP address, which are scarce. You know, I'm not saying that you only make your website work with, you know, browsers less than a month old, but at some point we have to cut people off. And, you know, I understand that that means that the most disadvantaged in our societies risk being left behind. But actually, when you think about who's stuck behind, it's actually large enterprises, right? It's the, you know, everyone has experienced this, right? So there's like some internal HR application designed in 1998 in Visual Basic by an intern, and that's a thing that everyone uses to put in their vacation time. And HR doesn't want to put the money into upgrading it because it works fine, but that one crappy intranet application is the reason why your entire organization still uses Internet Explorer. Large enterprise organizations are dinosaurs when it comes to upgrading. But they are the ones that have the resources to upgrade. They just choose to not do so. And I do think that at some point you have to cut people off. You know, when we moved from analog TV to digital TV a few years back, they gave out $50 vouchers that you could use to go and buy a digital TV tuner. I'm not opposed to something similar to, you know, allow people to go to the Geek Squad and upgrade their computer to Windows 8. If that's how we have to do it, we have to do it. But, you know, given the extent to which people in DC talk about the importance of cybersecurity, you would think as a country we should be focusing on cybersecurity. And if we are going to live in a society where a significant portion of the population are using 10-year-old web browsers and 10-year-old operating systems, we're not taking cybersecurity seriously. And so I think we have to get everyone using up-to-date software. Otherwise, there's no way to protect ourselves. Thank you again. Enjoy the rest of the conference.